Hello and welcome to episode 64 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Well, good evening, Matt. Here we are, number 64. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me, etc.? And we're actually there. How do you feel about that?
That's a hexadecimal important number, isn't it?
Oh, it's a loads of important. It's powers of two, isn't it? It's important in the powers of two, and it is what the Commodore was, one of those powers of two that becomes a RAM number in our youths.
Yeah, I can. I've got the ability to be able to count up in powers of two to quite a high number for no reason I can work out at all, other than computer memory. Interestingly, I was just checking my computer. Sorry. It's going to be one of those shows. I was just checking my computer, and I've just upgraded to the slightly more expensive version of G Suite, the Google thing. And I've now got a drive mapped on my computer that it says basically 364 megabytes used of one exabyte.
Exabyte?
An exabyte.
I don't even know what an exabyte
is. An exabyte is basically, as somebody on Twitter just told me, that's an awful lot of cat photos.
It's a lot of cat photos. Is it like 1,000 gigabytes, I guess, something like that? Terabytes.
Well, no, that's a petabyte, isn't it?
Is it? Let's just say that if you fill it up, then you're going to have an enormous filing challenge on your hands.
Exactly. I'm locked in. But yeah, how's your week been?
This week's been fun. The week's only just started, hasn't it? The weekend was okay, and last week was pretty productive, and lots of good stuff going on. Various, new things happening. Got doing a presentation for a business next week about blockchain, which I was researching and trying to update my knowledge. Which I tell you, the blockchain world has exploded since last year. Since the I did the ITDF. In fact, I did the Finance Directors Forum, actually, running alongside the ITDF. And I had researched the blockchain stuff and updated my knowledge then. Coming to update that now, there's just no end to it. It was a fairly big topic then, but it's amazing now. Just the amount of utter crap knocking about around blockchain. Masquerading as fact, but there's also a lot of interesting stuff in there. It's not all rubbish. I'm not going to be a naysayer, but it's everybody's got a blockchain something.
Yes, I think that's we are very much, we're not even peak blockchain yet either. That's the worrying bit. Yes, I don't know. I'm still skeptical. I still don't see in many applications of it other than things that could be much better done with a database. But this is what these. Trying to find a use for technologies is a perfectly valid use of technology. This is how we find things that are useful. And usually, actually, what we find is that what they were initially intended for isn't the thing they were very good for, and that we find something useful that is completely unexpected. So I look forward to that with blockchain, but I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, so what about yourself? How's your week been?
Good. I think I got a new client, which is nice. Launched a new podcast last week with Natalia. There'll be episode 2 of that going out tomorrow. We'll keep it in the WB40 stream for maybe 2 or 3 episodes. And then if you want to continue with the little drawing fun, then we'll shift it over to its own feed. But that's a really nice response to that, which has been good. And apart from that, actually, at this moment, Watford are playing, just going into the end of the first half. And so if I'm not listening or watching it, then it's like Schrodinger's match. But then when I get back to it, I know that we'll probably have been hammered.
Well, don't worry about it. It's I think you're not going to get relegated, eh?
Don't know. It's touch and go. We're still not mathematically safe, and it's one of those seasons. We did, though, interestingly, come top of the... The Guardian did an article about utter incompetence, and they do these league tables based on how utterly incompetent a team is, including things like throw-ins directly to the opposition and yellow cards of taking tops off at goal-scoring celebrations and all this kind of thing. And Watford are not only streets ahead of this table, But it looks like we have the possibility to be the first club to win the Utter Incompetence League without actually getting relegated, which is no mean feat, I'd say.
Yeah, it's nice to have aspirations.
Indeed. So it's that time of the week where we enter into the part of the show that really should have a jingle by now but still doesn't. It's Chris and Matt's yin and yang of the internet. Mr. Weston, your choices this week. What has got on your internet goat with your internet yin?
Well, the internet yin is actually today's. It's today's goat that's been got on. Only very briefly, and I don't like to dwell on the yin. So let's get it out of the way. And it was our new Home Secretary, the promoted, I guess, Saqib Javid. And it's nothing really about his appointment. I think we all knew that it's pretty much. I don't think there was anybody left really who could be Home Sec other than him. But it was just a picture of him that floated past my vision today, and I've seen it a few more times since. Is of him standing outside Marsham Street in his new role in the Tory power pose, which I thought was one of those things they did in a way day, didn't they? I don't know. It seemed to come out of some kind of Conservative Party branding exercise where they all started standing with their legs spread really far apart. I mean, almost painfully far apart in this power pose. Theresa May and it was quite creepy, but I thought it was one of those things that they've all been told to do, so they were doing it and it would fade away. But no, there's old Saqib himself. They're doing it outside Marsham Street today, looking like one of those guys from the Blackadder episode with the actors spreading their about to roar and launch into a soliloquy. So he was, yes, that was my yin today.
To be fair, outside Marsham Street can get slightly slippery, and it was very wet today, so it could have just been lack of friction. But anyway, thank you for that. Bring us then to your internet yang.
So this is something I think I mentioned. I've been doing some blockchain research, and as I was doing so, I came across my old notes from last year, and I came across a website that I'd forgotten about, really, and I was glad I rediscovered it. And it is now, and I want people to be aware that there is a swear coming up, and it's whatthefuckisethereum.com. And it's a great little website because it explains Ethereum in fairly simple language. But I like the concept. I like the concept of this website because it allows you to choose a style in which it should explain it, or a kind of persona that you have chosen that you wanted explained like. And it starts explain it like an average person just trying to get by. And there's a page of stuff about Ethereum, which is kind of interesting and useful, with a couple of links. But you can choose a total nerd, and there's a whole bunch of very interesting links. Or you can say, I'm an entrepreneur, and it'll tell you about tokens and raising money through ICOs. And you can now choose, I'm a scammer, and it'll tell you a lot more about ICOs and Ponzi schemes. It's just a really, I like the style of this. I think lots of websites should present their information in different styles to suit the kind of the background of the reader. I think it's a way forward.
Excellent. So, the name of the website again is
whatthefuckisethereum.com.
Fantastic. We'll put a link to that on the webpage, along with possibly only a link to Power Stance Tories. That's it for this week on Matt and Chris's Yin and Yang of the Internet.
So also today, given that we've been talking about good and bad, you also have noticed an article, a Spectator article, about video conferencing. And it's quite an interesting article, isn't it? But there's a bit more to it than that.
Yeah, so Rory Sutherland, who is, I don't know what his job title is now, something at Ogilvy and Mather. They've, I think, rebranded it back to what it used to be. He's an interesting guy. He's got some very interesting opinions about a number of things. And the article, he writes a column in The Spectator, which is, I think it's called Wikiman, and it's kind of advertising person's take on technology and stuff. And the ostensibly the article this week is about a conferencing device which looks like an owl and sits in the middle of a table and has eyes and speakers and 3D microphones and stuff. And it's kind of just the next generation of those kind of conference systems with 360 degree cameras and what have you. And it's just the interesting, and I tweeted just a little screenshot of his last paragraph, which was just basically saying, actually, is there though a bigger problem, which is since we've imported the American culture of needing to be seen to be busy at work to be able to show that you have value, and that all of this stuff is just the kind of manifestation of that busyness problem. And I tweeted that out, and there's lots of people have kind of commented it on or retweeted it or whatever. But it got me then just thinking a bit more about this concept. And it's certainly something in the research I've done over the last few years around collaborative technologies in particular, that I've seen very, very little evidence to show that collaboration tools are actually necessarily making anybody more productive. And that actually, in many cases, the sales pitch for a collaboration platform is that it is better than the one that you use at the moment, which isn't saying that it makes you more productive. It just makes you less not productive than other technology that you're already using. Usually that technology cited is email. And that it's just possibly all a bit crap, really. And then you've got these issues around how a lot of these technologies will then take friction out of the system because of the West Coast American obsession with making everything frictionless, and that in itself makes things even worse. So you end up with, you know, things like the network diary systems that we've been using for 15, 20 years now, which make it way too easy to make way too big a meeting with way too many people. And then you combine that with conferencing technologies, and that makes it even easier to bring in even more people into a meeting that they don't need to be there. And most people, I think, these days in modern organisations, they look at meetings as dead time. And there's something fundamentally wrong when you've got to that point. And that this just seems weird. And then that these cultural things about busyness being really important to show how busy you are all the time are so embedded in the software that we use. There's cultural assumptions that basically start from the principle that you are too busy, and therefore all software for work and collaboration is there to be able to deal with your overriding busyness. And it means that you end up with things that are making you even more busy as a result. I saw an example this morning. I had a meeting at 11 o'clock at about 7:30 on the train. I wanted to send a note to the person who'd organised the meeting to say, is the meeting still on? It's a good, you know, polite thing to do. And went into Google Calendar and pressed the button to say, email the organiser. And then I had four automatic options. And every single one of those options was predicated on the idea that I was too busy. It was, sorry, I'm running late, I'll be there in 10 minutes, or I'm sorry, I can't make it today, can we reschedule? And all of the options that were made available to me, they were just built on the principle that I didn't have enough time to be able to do that meeting. And that's worrying when we've got that kind of stuff going on, and it's kind of reinforcing this changing culture.
I think it's true. I think one of the things that's reinforced it is presence. So the idea that it's useful that you can see whether somebody is free or not free. So people have started to find ways to defend their time by finding non-activities so that people don't bother them in the time where they are supposedly free, as if all day we should be, you know, almost crying out in pain because there's so much stuff going on. I've worked in places where you can go up to people and they say, how are you doing? They go, oh, I'm so busy. Oh, dear me, I'm so busy. Oh, it's horrendous. But it, when you actually look in, into what they're doing and the kind of work they're doing, the work they're doing is mainly responding to requests from other people. And if you just take a just a step back and or like a, just a step up and look down, it's like pass the parcel. They're busy passing all this stuff around, right? Nothing's coming out of it. There's no result, but they're busy following the process. They're busy serving the process and ticking boxes rather than actually producing anything. And this was you could see nothing was coming out of this process. It was clear nothing was happening, but everybody was always so busy. We didn't have any capacity. We needed more people. It's a I think that's a consequence of us needing to show this kind of useful behavior and set our calendars to I'm in this meeting or I'm in that meeting, or I'm going to go to that meeting, even though what's it going to achieve. And there's always that kind of thought that goes around every now and again that says, well, look, you shouldn't go to a meeting. You shouldn't go to a meeting that hasn't got an agenda, that hasn't got an outcome. You shouldn't go. But guess what? Other people will just go to those meetings, and then you'll end up getting the work because you weren't the one there telling them, you know, giving them a reason why these things shouldn't happen. There are meeting cultures in business that are driven again by this foolish idea that unless you are 100% utilized, like a electric motor that's not sat idle, then it's a waste of investment, that you're not doing anything. Really, really crazy.
And I think also, I mean, two concepts that have come to me out of these conversations over the last 8 hours or so. The first is, I probably do my best work when I'm not doing anything at all. That's the point at which I solve problems. That's the point at which stuff that is seemingly intractable becomes clear. And that often doesn't happen in the workday either. But the other thing is that actually, what would software look like if it was predicated on the idea that we're not too busy? And I think it's really difficult to conceptualize that, because so much of the stuff that we have around us is based on the idea of being able to either squeeze more stuff in or make it more, you know, manageable. And actually, if you started from the principle of saying, I've got plenty of time, how should I now work? I can't think of a single piece of business software that would enable me to use that time productively.
Maybe you need to go and live on a mountain. Maybe we need to. Maybe we don't need technology. Maybe we should abandon it. Why are we even doing this?
Well, actually, interesting there. The sorts of things that I do know that actually work within that are kind of creative tools. So, the music software that I noodle around with, or some of the drawing software that I use on the iPad now, actually, that's quite good at being able to use time that doesn't have structure and doesn't have output and purpose quite effectively, but not efficiently or necessarily even productively. But I don't know, that's the obsession with productivity as well, I guess. And that comes back to that thing we were talking to Ember Berman about way at the beginning of the year, which was actually how much of this stems out of the Protestant work ethic and that idea that you go to heaven if you are working really hard, which is so deeply rooted in Northern European culture. It's definitely into United States culture, and that's a really it's very pervasive into this idea that you're not, you know, you're sinning if you're not working hard.
And we've got another interview, which is a relief to everybody to stop us wittering on. And this week it's a lady called Ina Yulo, and she's a content marketer from a company called BrightTalk. And Matt spoke to Ina about content marketing and some of the things that technology companies maybe need to think about when they do these things. And in a very sensible opening to this conversation, Matt asked her, what is content marketing?
So it's a funny one. The way that I see content marketing, and of course the way that the actual Content Marketing Institute also describes it, is it is a marketing technique that curates, creates, and distributes information or experiences. So that can be blog articles, that can be webinars, videos, to people. But the thing is, the main difference here is that it's no longer the hard sell that we were used to. It's something that will hopefully be relevant, consistent, and valuable for the audience, in hopes that they encourage them to make a change in their behavior, which can then, at the very end of it, potentially lead to a purchasing decision.
So, marketing without a clear call to action, maybe?
I actually think that a clear call to action is still something that many content marketers need, because a lot of the time their main goal at the end of whatever content they're publishing, be that a white paper or a blog article, is to get someone's contact details and sign them up for a newsletter or a subscription of some sort where they can then feed them more information and actually push them down further into the sales funnel.
And okay, one thing that strikes me, is this particularly new?
It's one of those things where it's like, it's been around for ages, but then someone put a nice little new name on it, and then suddenly everyone's treating it like a completely different animal. So my background's in advertising and marketing. And I remember when I was doing my master's in it, that was about, 6 years ago now, every class and every teacher told us, the customer is king, the customer is king, to the point that it was really annoying that was the only thing we were being told. I graduate, and suddenly the year after, content is king. So it's like it's that shift, but then the shift is not exactly there if you think about it, because when we were saying the customer is king, when we create content, that content is still targeted at a particular target audience, and that's the very important thing as well, is that you shouldn't be creating content for content's sake or content for just everybody, but you should have your target persona in mind and your target audience in mind, and your content should be able to actually attract that audience and eventually acquire it. But going back to your point, that's not new. That's been marketing for quite some time now.
So I wonder maybe what has changed is because of the internet, which has given access to everybody to the means of distribution.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one thing that's changed as well, so the internet has also made it so that content marketing is more accessible. So it's more accessible for those who are producing the content and, be those the Instagram influencers who would consider themselves, honestly, to be content marketers, but also the people who are actually accessing it. Because, like you said, we now have so many different alleys for us to actually educate and inform ourselves. So that's why I think there are so many new, techniques that come into content marketing, and that it is a lot more important because people are consuming a lot of content and content in so many different ways. So it's actually harder to get to your target audience because it's harder to kind of, sift through the swamp of content and information out there.
Something that Chris and I have spoken on more than one occasion, and a number of other people I know had this conversation over the years. What is it about the tech industry that makes it so hard for them to do anything than relentlessly talk about their product?
So I've talked about this quite a lot too. So I gave a workshop in Oslo a few weeks ago. It was for a fintech accelerator, and that was one of my main points. Is that so? My background, the job I do now actually is I help clients in the fintech and financial services space to get their content out to their target audiences. And one of the biggest mistakes I've seen, and this is especially in the fintech startup world, is that there's so much focus on the tech, too much focus on the tech. And it's almost like, here's the tech we have, look how great this is. And you fall into that sort of that bubble where you know your tech, you know your company, you know your benefits, and you expect that the whole world should see that too and should accept it. But the problem there is that there will always be someone else who has a better product than you or a more innovative product than you. And if you focus on just that one thing, no one's really going to listen to you. So I always say, focus on showing people that you are an expert in solving the problem that they actually have. So it's always about starting with the problem first. What is that problem? And then finding a solution for it. And I think that that's the issue with the tech companies, is that a lot of the time as well, people within the tech industry, especially if people within the marketing functions, I actually think that marketing was not necessarily in their background. They were actually more techie people, and then the company was formed, and then one of us here has to be the marketer. So you're going to be the marketer now. But then that person still has that product mindset, and that is how they're going to be generating the demand, which is just not always the case. It's not going to work.
It's interesting that the with all of the change there's been over the last 15 years or so in terms of getting to more user-focused product design, actually the marketing end of software companies is still product rather than user-focused, and that the kind of agile approach to developing the products hasn't necessarily filtered through to the end of the business that sells it.
Very true, and it's funny because we have an audience growth team at BrightTalk, and they are adopting that agile method of working. And it's something that, you know, me myself, I'm a little iffy about, because it's not necessarily how I work. So that, you know, there again, is that it, I'm not used to that style of working. And the product focus thing, I think that one thing that also that's a detriment to tech marketers is that they are inundated with product every single day. Every meeting that a tech marketer has on a regular basis is about, here are the new features of our product, here's what makes our product different. So naturally, that's the messaging that they end up coming out with, and it's so hard to deviate from that. You know, it's like, I'm not putting down tech marketers, because I've been there too. You know, it's a common mistake that I make, and language is actually one that people don't talk about as often. So I have realized that within myself, and I'm trying to tone back that when I go to events and I go to networking things, I talk to people about, you know, the work we do, and I use certain words which to me are just, you know, I use it naturally, it's something I use every day, and I realize these words and terms are actually very BrightTalk specific, so we use them internally on such a regular basis that I just assume that everyone around me understands them. And like I said, it took people telling me, wait, sorry, so as a prime example, we run regular online events called the BrightTalk Summits. So to me, summit is a regular word in the English language. People get it. So I'll say, oh yeah, we have a summit next week, blah, blah, blah. And someone goes, sorry, a summit? What is that? Where are you holding it? That's when I realized, oh no, not everyone in this world knows that when I say summit, it's an online-only event. It's an actual event with different sessions going on, blah, blah, blah. But it does take someone telling me that for me to realize what I'm doing wrong.
This is probably just, you know, communications 101, and not even in marketing, just in general, good. How do you communicate? How do you get message across? We all need to sell. And the need to be able to use language that is empathetic, and to use the language of the person you're trying to communicate to, not your language, is... Oh, this is just rules for life, really. But it is really hard, because we're wrapped up in stuff, and we... day to day, we know what it is we're talking about, and we have the shortcuts, and we use language that has embedded meaning that we understand, but it all falls apart, then we need to actually get those messages across to somebody else.
I completely agree. And you know, turning that conversation back even to content marketing, that is something that people also forget when they are actually producing content. Are they speaking in their own language, or are they speaking in the language that their target audience actually wants to be communicated in that style, in that format, in words and in language that they can actually understand?
Do you think we're into a world which is becoming increasingly blurred in the sense of people not really being able to identify what is, I guess, real anymore? You know, what is content marketing? What is honest content? What is advertising? What is the content that isn't content marketing in media? It all feels very, very... I think this is different. That it does feel now more blurred and difficult to discern than ever before.
I think just all of the labels make, you know, don't really make the case any easier. Is that, when was it? A few years ago, there was native advertising was the big thing, right? There's native advertising, and then there's content marketing, there's inbound marketing, all of these different things. There's growth hacking as well now. And it's all buzzwords, really. And again, you know, to your point, did we have this 10 years ago? Probably, but they were not labeled, and there was no focus on actually improving those sorts of skills. So I think that the blurriness is very much there. And I think, you know, as we talked about previously, is the labels sometimes make it difficult, because then you get called out for not being genuine. If you say, oh, this is one thing, and then suddenly it starts blurring into the other direction, and then you get called out, oh, you said it was one thing though, so why is it now, you know, switching gears?
I guess if we look at what's been going on with the stuff around Facebook over the last few weeks, and actually, I think there's been some people, I've been quite, actually no, probably not that surprised, but it's been quite upsetting to see quite a lot of people in the sort of tech world taking a view, oh, people are so stupid, didn't they know this was always going on? I think it's actually quite hard to know what's going on where. And there's also then blurred out, so for, you know, this podcast, you could see that as Chris and me doing content marketing, which I guess to an extent we are. Actually, Chris and I do it because we enjoy doing it and we find it interesting. It gives us the chance to go and, it's an excuse to go and meet people and talk with them, which is great. And if other people get value out of what is us basically in our strange middle-aged ways enjoying ourselves, then great. But it's not a conscious thing. We're not designing it. We're not, you know, we're not putting a lot of effort into thinking about, well, will the audience like this or not? We do stuff, and if it works, it works, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. I wouldn't have that freedom if I was working in a content marketing department somewhere, I don't think.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think it's one of those things, you know, talking about blurred, when do the passions and interests turn into a career as well? So that's another line that people talk about. You know, it's like, oh, here's my daytime job and here's my passion project. And then a lot of the time, those passion projects or those side hustles, as the millennials of this generation call it now, a lot of the time, you start really getting into it and you realize, oh, you know, when that light bulb goes off and you realize, oh, maybe I can actually make money out of this. And I mean, honestly, who doesn't want that to be a benefit of your side hustle or your passion project? So then you get into it. And then I think that there's something that's completely great about the fact that you and Chris are doing it, again, not for any content marketing purposes, but for your own fulfillment. You enjoy doing it. And I think that's completely great. And the thing is, you also will learn things throughout these conversations, obviously, that you then can use in your professional lives, but that doesn't have to be your main goal. And that's completely fine, I think, if it's not your main goal, if it's a kind of it's collateral damage, you know, to what you're actually doing.
Where do you think honesty and authentic, that's a horrendous term that's authentic. Used a lot, is this authentic? And of course, brands themselves, brands are completely inauthentic. They're totally fabricated mm-hmm. things. Yes. The idea of an authentic brand is a complete oxymoron. But for individuals, do you think content marketing is making it harder or easier for people to be able to portray themselves in a way that is honest to themselves?
In my personal opinion, I think it can be a challenge, but I think it's doable. Because for me, so it's funny, ever since I started, you know, coming out and talking and doing speaking things, I was always concerned, for example, that, you know, my style of how I speak during events and during professional meetings and things is very similar to how I am in my regular out-of-work life. And I started thinking, oh, am I not going to be taken seriously? Because I'm quite a bubbly person, if you haven't already noticed. But then I thought, to be any different, it would just be so incredibly clear to anybody I was talking to that wasn't me, that I was being inauthentic. So I actually, when you know, with that question of yours, what I can think about are influencer marketing and how it was a big thing as well, and it still is quite, you know, quite big. But people are very...
Just explain the term.
Yes, sorry. So influencer marketing is especially seen within Instagram, where there are certain people who have a large following, and brands are now paying them for sponsored ads. So, the Kardashians are probably the biggest ones out there who do get paid for sponsored posts, who get paid to mention a brand in their Insta stories and things like that. So they really, I think, pushed forward in this revolution of influencer marketing. But then very recently, actually, just a few months ago probably, all of these articles started coming out saying that influencers actually don't have any influence. And here's the issue, and I saw a really good article about this. They were talking about the difference between influencers, where there was one influencer who was a blockbuster actress who had probably millions of followers on Instagram, and she was posing with a picture with some instant noodles. And people were saying, your other photos are of you eating out with your chef boyfriend in Michelin star restaurants around the world. Do you really expect me to believe that you eat, you know, instant noodles? Whereas there was another influencer who was in the film industry, much smaller scale, only a few thousand followers, but they were saying, the moment that he says, oh, this movie that just came out is amazing, everyone should go see it, people actually would. Because he is a trusted source within that industry. And, you know, if the actress talked about maybe, I don't know, acting tips, people would follow that too. But instant noodles, when she's been eating out in Michelin star restaurants, and she can't hide that because she's been posting that on Instagram.
Yeah, and it's that consistency, isn't it, that is interesting. I think as well that when you were talking, there's some good advice I heard years and years back, which was about presenting. So doing talks and whatever, but I think this applies across a lot of these things, is that it's not acting. You had to be a good actor to act, and a bad actor is really obvious. But it is performing. And so there's something about how you have to be able to put additional energy in and to be able to amplify certain bits and just make it a little bit more larger than life. And that probably applies as much for people doing things. You know, I'm much more ranty and argumentative when I'm talking with Chris on this than, actually no, I'm not. I'm actually pretty much like that in real life as well. But you know, my written articles are much more, you know, I'm making a point in a way that I wouldn't quite as stridently make a point in a conversation with somebody. But that balance between performance, normality and acting, actually it takes some time. It takes time to find voice. And actually for an organisation, it also takes time to find voice. It's not just the voice of the individuals, but also the corporate voice is something that has to be found. And this is,
I think it's that's so true. It's the tone of voice, and it takes a while, like you said, for an organization to develop that tone of voice. And when you are speaking on behalf of an organization, you need to, even if it's not your tone of voice personally, you need to be able to, I think, embrace the organization's tone of voice. So again, in a way, I think you put it really well in the terms of putting it. It's a performance. It's not acting, but a performance. It's picking the bits of your own personality maybe that match the organization's tone of voice and amplifying that, even if in your own personal life that bit of you is not necessarily what stands out to most people. You need to find that one angle that you have and the ability to speak within that, your company's tone of voice, and then that's what you portray to the rest of the world, because you need to keep that authenticity not necessarily with you but with your company and who you're representing.
And interestingly, actually, in business to business, here's a weird thing. For business to business, because it tends to be about smaller numbers, and certainly from the work I've done in the past with work at Microsoft in particular, actually business to business marketing depends much more on the people and the personalities than consumer marketing, because you are dealing with smaller volumes, and actually it's the people that are trusted. It's if you're, you know, making a decision about buying something from another company, you're making that decision mostly on the basis of the people that you're dealing with, not the company itself.
Yeah, very true. And that's why it's so important, again, still to do, you know, I'm a big fan of persona exercises, right? And we've done it a lot at Brighto because our targets are the B2B marketers, actually. They are the people who do purchase our products on behalf of their entire marketing department or their entire companies. So that's all the way from big corporations to smaller startups. And it's interesting because those people, especially, you know that they carry the weight of that decision, and it's so important to be able to talk in their language to their needs. So, you know, I think a needs analysis is another thing that people always forget about. You know, look into what are the actual needs of this specific persona that you'd like to talk to. And not just that, but I think a very important part also is what are their fears. So we've seen, of course, B2B marketers, what are their biggest fears? That they spend some money and don't get any ROI and then get sacked.
And if we look over the next, I don't know, 18 months or so, particularly within B2B content, what trends do you see emerging? What things do you think we're going to see more of as the next couple of years develop?
So one thing that's really interesting, I think, I haven't really seen a lot of it in the B2B space, but I can imagine it potentially happen. Here I am, crystal ball, and then it never happens, but we'll see, right? So a big struggle with B2B marketing when it comes to content especially is just churning out more content. And that's why repurposing content is something that a lot of people are doing now. And I read an article yesterday saying why you shouldn't feel bad about repurposing content. Imagine it's an emotional thing now that you feel bad about it. But so one trend I think would be really cool to see, and I think it might happen, is the rise of user generated content. Of brands or, you know, big companies actually using content that their customers are already creating and being able to either join up and say, let's do a joint post on that, or you have already created this, you know, let's take that and see how we can use that too. Because that also, I think, builds on the authenticity factor, that there are certain people who are creating the content for you without you actually going out there and telling them, hey, here's some money, can you write this for me, can you create this video for me, but they're doing it out of their own will. And then that's turning into just a really good way for the content marketing team to actually take a break maybe and not work so hard, but just use that really authentic piece. And one, I think, you know, Snapchat's already doing it, if you think about it. They're, you know, dealing with different events around the world and collecting all of the videos that people are taking at different events. And then they can put it all together, and then that's really great content for the brand. And it's more authentic, not created by that event, but by the users who were there.
So thanks to Ina for making the time to have a chat. I tell you what, the thing that I found, having had a week or so to reflect on that conversation, is how those kind of techniques for marketing haven't translated at all into the way in which we communicate internally within organisations. That when it comes to technology teams or IT teams or whatever, we just do bloody product pitches or very direct, you must do this type of communication still. There's no thought about how you build up a relationship through interesting, compelling, idea-led stuff. It's just really very base, really, isn't it, internally?
It is, and I think it it also talks to this idea that that in an organization internally, you can make some assumptions about what people mean by certain things. And that can work in an organization, especially where you're in a jargon heavy environment, if you're in teaching or healthcare or whatever, and you know what ENT is, or you have a lexicon, don't you, that you use. But it's one thing when it's an industry standard lexicon. When it comes into a company, you almost have your own little sub language, which evolves to the point where sometimes nobody's really sure where it came from or what it meant in the first place. And therefore, even that can have different definitions depending on who's talking about it, because they weren't there when it was created. A bit like the monkeys being electrocuted when they go for the food. You know, that that thing where they keep taking where all the monkeys get a shock, and then you replace one of the monkeys with a new monkey, and the monkey goes for the food, and all the monkeys beat the monkey up and say, don't go and get the food, because we'll all get a shock. And then one by one, you replace all the monkeys until any new monkey that goes for the food is immediately beaten up. But none of the monkeys in the cage have ever had a shock. But they just know that they mustn't go for the food, and they beat up the newcomers. And it's a bit like that, where new people come in and they pick up this lexicon, but they get a slightly different explanation of it. And we don't know what we're talking about. And it's but nobody knows. And I thought I was, I thought there was a lot of sense in that, and we can reflect on that, even in small organisations, that we can reflect on how we use language and what are we talking about, and stop assuming that everybody understands it.
It also has made me think again about what I do with blogging and doing this and doing other bits and bobs, and the extent to which I go through these cycles of thinking, oh, this is content marketing what I'm doing. No, it's not. And I think there is an honesty. You know, you and I do, as I said in the interview, you and I do this mostly because of some weird, perverse enjoyment we get from it, which is just, you know, let's not call him Freud.
I stopped enjoying getting about 32, but I'm still doing
it. It's a sense of duty now. The ability for people who work independently or individuals to be able to do stuff and to be able to do it just because the enjoyment, and if other people get something from it, that's great. And then the thing about working out loud and being able to work out loud because it's just an easier way to get stuff done, much more effective way of getting stuff done. And then there's something, though, that when a corporate hits it and it turns into this kind of pure form content marketing, or even just bad form content marketing. And I think, you know, blogging that goes on within a lot of government departments at the moment, I just find it's not anything honest at all. It's because I know the process is, it goes through, you know, X level of bloody editorial control. That's not blogging. That's just publicity in the older sense of the term. It's nothing new. It's nothing about working out loud. And I think organisations really, really struggle to be able to take on board the human element of this sometimes.
I think that is true. I think actually some of that blogging and internal publicity is almost goes back to our previous conversation about, look what we're doing, aren't we brilliant? We've just done this, even though they really haven't. And it's all horse feathers, and we end up with internal fake news. It's pretty depressing, I guess. I did like the idea, actually. I was struck by one of the things in the interview was, we are essentially the Kardashians of the technology blog podcast space, I would say. I think we've got that cachet now.
There we go. WB40, Kardashians for tech. Yeah, marvellous. Ina, thank you very much again for taking part in that, and we'll put contact details for her if you want to get in touch, find out more about BrightTalk. So another episode disappears off into the sunset. Thank you for joining us this week. I don't know what we've got on next week. I don't think we have an interview planned, which is the first time in a while, so it might just be the two of us battling on. Hopefully we'll do something interesting in the next 7 days to be able to give us something interesting to talk about. It's a bank holiday next week as well, though, isn't it? And I'm away, so maybe there won't be a show at all next week.
Good Lord, we might end up waiting a little bit of time for number 65. Well, I've got a couple of things I'm doing next week. I'm going to give this blockchain talk that I mentioned. I'm also discussing artificial intelligence at a British Computer Society event in Birmingham next week as well. All things being equal, or is that next week or is it the week after? Do you know what? I forget. Anyway. I should be preparing all that sort of stuff anyway. And I might, maybe in that preparation, something will come to mind that we can talk about. Or maybe we'll both be on holiday because it's a bank holiday. Who can tell?
Who knows? Who knows? But anyway, we will. We've also got another draw pod coming out the day after this. So if you've heard this on the Monday, it'll be coming out on Tuesday. And if not, it will probably be in your stream already. Do take part. There's a fantastic thing to draw to this week. It's a most remarkable sound. And thanks to everybody who's taken part in the first one. We've been really blown away by the response. Apart from you, Chris, I've noticed.
I was just feeling a bit guilty about that I haven't listened to that yet. And thinking to myself, what if people think about podcasts? It's not TV, so it's not live. And therefore, you know, if you want to catch up on them, you'll be scribbling away, but everybody else would have long ago thrown away their little drawings, and you'll have nobody to talk to about. So it's kind of something you have to be in the time with, don't you? I promise I'll listen to the next one.
We are creating podcasting moments.
Thanks for listening. You can, of course, as always, catch us at WB40 Podcast on Twitter. You can catch us on the website at WB40podcast.com. or on our WhatsApp group, and the link can be found on the website.